This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, Spotlight on African Elections in Zimbabwe and Mali. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. In Zimbabwe, the ruling ZANU-PF candidate and current president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, won a slim victory over MDC opposition leader Nelson Chamisa. However, the poll, the first since 1980 without authoritarian leader Robert Mugabe on the ballot, was marred by violence and charges of fraud. For many Zimbabweans who have not known any other leader than Robert Mugabe, his ouster last year in a coup had raised expectations of a new era. But the narrow victory of Mnangagwa, who served as Mugabe's right-hand man and was behind some of the most repressive policies, revealed that power may be passing from one ZANU-PF diehard to another. Meantime, the opposition Movement for Democratic Change Alliance is gearing up to challenge the official results in court. A spokesman for the MDC says that many senior members of the opposition have gone into hiding, fearing arrests or abductions since the election. And while all eyes are on Zimbabwe, elections in Mali are arguably equally important, given the security and geopolitical interests at stake for Europe and the United States. Malians are set to vote again on Sunday, August 12, to choose their president from the two remaining candidates. The runoff will see President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, also known as Ibika, go up against Soumala Cisse for the second time in 5 years. In the first round of Mali's presidential election on July 29, Ibika officially won 41.7% of the vote. Cisse came a distant second with 17.8%. However, the poll was marred by widespread allegations of corruption, rigging, and vote buying. Well, joining us to discuss the significance and fallout from the Zimbabwe elections and preview the runoff in Mali are two distinguished regional analysts. J. Peter Pham is Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and that's a think tank based here in Washington, and John Tomaszewski, also known as JT. He's the Regional Director for Africa at the International Republican Institute, and that's a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization committed to advancing freedom and democracy worldwide. Its U.S. counterpart is NDI, the National Democratic Institute. JT currently oversees active IRI projects in a number of African countries, from the DRC to Zimbabwe. And JT just returned from Zimbabwe, where he took part in the IRI Election Observer mission there. And both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, JT, let me begin with you, since you just got back from Zimbabwe. Talk about your observations. Were these elections free and fair in your view?
Well, first, we participated as international observers under a U.S.-funded mission that was a joint mission between IRI and NDI. We had a really strong leadership team of two former female presidents in Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who's the former president of Liberia, and the former president of Central African Republic, Catherine Samba-Panza, as the interim president. And in addition to that, we had two former assistant secretaries of state for African affairs, Johnny Carson and Constance Newman, and a member of the House of Representatives, Karen Bass, who is the ranking member on the Africa subcommittee. So it was quite a large contingent, a super group to have out there. We looked at those elections all the way back from the last election in terms of our observation. We didn't just look at election day. Our long-term observers got on the ground as early as April and have been monitoring in all 10 provinces, not only in the provinces, but also in the capital, where we had additional experts. Our work really looked at the preparations and the lead-up for this election, the way in which the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission, the ZEC, undertook its preparations, particularly in terms of winning voter confidence and getting voters to feel safe that they could go to the polls. Zimbabwe has a history of violent elections. They have a history of intimidation. And while there was an open campaigning process, really allowing the opposition Movement for Democratic Change Alliance to go out and move into areas they previously couldn't under the Mugabe regime, voters still had a lot of fear. And in public opinion research that was done prior to the election by Afrobarometer, it was very clear that voters still had issues related to when they went to the polls, was something going to happen to them? Was retribution going to occur? What we're seeing now, after an election day that was largely peaceful, after an election day where people were orderly and participated, where polls opened on time, we basically now are seeing issues of retribution, occurring against opposition agents and also leaders within the opposition alliance, including Tendai Biti, who is a principal in the MDC alliance. So some of these fears that people had into going to the polls are now coming true for people who supported them. We're hearing about markets being kicked over in parts of Harare where there were supporters who voted for MDC. We're seeing election agents who want to get copies of these V11 forms, these results forms, to help support the court case that we understand the opposition will be filing Thursday. So there's a lot of issues here that are still unpacking. Our team is still on the ground, and we intend to be there actually for another month to look at this process in a post-election context as well.
So turning to you, J. Peter Pham, it was a very narrow victory. And as JT was saying, you know, some of the fears of those who voted for the opposition are perhaps starting to materialize and actually come true in a very negative way. We do know that there was somewhat of an uneven playing field, that certainly the ruling ZANU-PF had the advantage with the state-run media, even announcing, you know, pay hikes and giving out free food and who knows, money, et cetera, to make people come out to vote. Notwithstanding all of that, give us your sense of the election, its significance, and what we're seeing so far.
Let me preface that, Carol, as well known, because in the Africa policy community, I'm no fan of ZANU-PF and probably have 2 decades of published writings critical of them. But that being said, the opposition in this particular case certainly fought valiantly, but they didn't help themselves along the way. A somewhat flawed standard bearer in Nelson Chamisa, who in the campaign was given to what could charitably be described as hyperbolic statements, fake news in American parlance, and he was constantly rebutted by the facts. That didn't help his appearance as a statesman or a leader. Furthermore, he also, during this campaign, 2 days before the election, announced that he wouldn't accept results if he didn't win. Built up expectations, and then we get into what could be called a chicken and egg problem. What came first, this repression or people being stoked up and behaving badly? Not that anything justifies shooting unarmed civilians, but given the military and the police have been wound up this way for 3 decades, it's not surprising they reacted that way when provoked. The other thing, final point I would make is, during the campaign, the opposition didn't help itself by being divided. The Movement for Democratic Change, the MDC, divided itself. The former deputy to longtime leader Morgan Tsvangirai, Dr. Thokozani Kupe, actually split from the MDC, ran her own ticket. And in several constituencies that the MDC alliance should have won, places like Bulawayo South, they lost because they ran more than one candidate, split the vote, and allowed ZANU-PF to come up through the middle and win in the first-past-the-post system there. So a lot of lessons to be learned. But now I think the key thing is not to focus on the past so much, other than understanding that, to figure out how we move forward.
Well, that's a good question, JT. How do we move forward with a disputed election, a very narrow victory for Mnangagwa, and then, of course, the use of lethal force when there was a delay in the announcement of the presidential election results? So those are important questions.
Those are important questions. A few areas that we need to cover in responding to this is that, first, there was a very credible, a sample-based observation conducted by a group called Zessen, who also was able to put out figures that put the actual election result that the ZEC put out within the margin of error. Now, allegations have been made, well, you know, the government knew this and they put their finger on the scales and they got just within, make sure they could avoid a runoff. The reality is, though, is that Chamisa was always the David versus the Goliath, a well-funded state machinery-led party with close ties to the military. It was always going to be the little guy versus the big guy. I think what Peter has put forward are some really important points that the opposition in the long term here, moving forward, is going to continue to have to go through the constitutional and legal processes that exist under the electoral process. They have to do that. Coming out a few days before the election and dismissing that you wouldn't accept a result if it doesn't go in your favor and saying, I'm going to dismiss the courts and they're not the way we'll go to the streets, just doesn't work very well. We saw that happen in the second runoff in Kenya, in that second vote. And I think for us as observers, what we're doing is looking really closely. Will the opposition file their case? Will Mnangagwa follow the Constitution and not be sworn in before that happens? We talked about August 12th as an important day for Mali. That is the date that Mnangagwa's people have declared that he will be sworn in. well, that would not really factor very well with the 14-day period that has to occur for this court case to be heard, which, again, the MDC Alliance has said that they will do. They will file something very soon. So I think these are some challenges that we're looking at in the medium term. The longer term, listen, Zimbabwe is running out of cash. They need that IMF loan. They need support from the Western democracies. They need engagement. They want it. It's not just being open for business, but it's also being open to the world. And those things have to happen, and they will happen, if Mnangagwa plays his cards right and follows the process and respects lives.
Well, back to you, J. Peter Pham. We're already hearing from senators here in the United States, Senator Chris Coons, a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, condemning the violence, the government-sponsored attacks in Zimbabwe, arbitrary detentions and arrests. So clearly, there will not be an appetite, as JT says, for the international community to support the Zimbabwean government and its need for economic assistance unless they do follow this process. And notwithstanding the unfortunate statements made by Nelson Chamisa before the election results came out and other criticisms that you leveled, you do have to wonder why the government resorted to violence to quell the opposition protests using, you know, tactics reminiscent of Mugabe. That, too, was not a good idea.
Well, Carol, I wasn't there and certainly was not in the mind of President Mnangagwa throughout all this. But one has to presume that he's a rational actor, and probably he didn't want it to happen. This was not his script that played out. However, what he should have done is anticipated that a military and a police force that was trained for decades under Mugabe to be brutal was going to operate on a hair trigger and didn't know how to control them, didn't have rules of engagement drilled into them. That takes years. It doesn't happen overnight. You don't send a memo out. You have to train for that. And knowing this, they probably should have been much more judicious in deploying those forces. So in that respect, I think the government is responsible for what happened, even if they were provoked. There's no justification for shooting unarmed civilians. That being said, however, we also have to look at moving forward. Zimbabwe is running out of cash. The region, certainly, there are already 3 million plus Zimbabweans who have left the country, are in neighboring countries. We don't want more, and certainly neighbors don't want more, destabilizes the region. So how do we move beyond this? And that's not rewarding bad behavior, but I think it's establishing very key benchmarks, not just respecting the constitutional process, but also substantive realization. Yes, the ZANU-PF candidate was declared the winner very narrowly, but that means a little less than half the country didn't vote for him. And yes, they may have won 2/3 of the National Assembly, the parliament, because of the dysfunctionality, let's say, of the opposition. But that doesn't mean that just because you have a majority, you have a right to do everything, or you should do. And just because you have a right to do something doesn't mean you should. And so I think there are benchmarks that the international community should establish. Let's not make it a moving target, but let's make it very clear so we all know what we're talking about.
Indeed, and we'll be watching Zimbabwe very carefully in the coming days and weeks. You're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are J. Peter Pham. He's Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and John Tomaszewski, also known as JT. He's Regional Director for Africa at the International Republican Institute. And we're discussing the implications of the recent elections in Zimbabwe and soon in Mali. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website, voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castillo VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Well, here's a shout out to Samin Nekzad from Mazar-i-Sharif, Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our discussion of elections, and let's turn now to Mali. And J. Peter Pham, you have your finger on the pulse there. I'd like you to remind us of the importance of the election in Mali that took place a couple of weeks ago and preview for us the runoff set to take place on Sunday.
In order to understand Mali, one has to remember and put everything in context that just a little over 5 years ago, this was a failed state. There had been a military coup. 2/3 of the country had been occupied by various Islamist extremist groups aligned with ethnic separatists. It took a French-led intervention in the beginning of 2013 to drive back the al-Qaeda-linked militants from the region. There's a UN peacekeeping force in the country known by its acronym MINUSMA, which has the dubious distinction of being the deadliest blue helmeted mission anywhere in the world. So from all this, the fact that an election took place, that there was some violence, not among the voters, but by extremist elements trying to disrupt the voting in some places because of lack of security, probably about a little over 3% of polling places couldn't open. But we have to take all that in the context that despite all this, the country held the second democratic election it's held since the coup. Before that, Mali had a tradition of constitutional rule for a long, long time. The election was held. Over 40% of the voters managed to get out and vote. And that's good by Malian standards. Only once before in Mali's history has it gone this high. And that was the last election when there was a very high turnout because people wanted to show that their support for return to constitutional order. So the incumbent president, Ibi Ka, received, according to the figures released officially by the Constitutional Court, 41.7% of the vote. So he's going to face off against Sumala Cisse, former prime minister, the same guy he faced off last time in the runoff. I think it will go to the voters, but it's very hard to see mathematically how Sumala Cisse makes up the difference.
So I'd like to get your view, JT, on what's at stake in this runoff election. And how do you see the difference between Ibi Ka and his rival, Sumala Cisse? Are they just personal rivals, or is there an ideological difference that the voters can look at?
Well, I think for Ibi Ka, you know, what you get is not necessarily strongman politics, but you certainly get somebody that people think can help hold the country together. So that's what his supporters look at. When they see someone like him, they see a strong leader, they want to rally around him. There's a lot of concern in the country about its future stability and sort of cohesion. And that really is what this election is about. Malians need to have the opportunity to go to the polls. They need to have the opportunity to express their voice, choose their leader, because that is not an easy thing to do in Mali. It's not an easy thing to do at any level in the government. And once you get that leader, getting that representation, we work in Mali. We have an office in Bamako. And I can tell you certainly that people's knowledge of what their leaders are doing and what this peace accord is all about, both are difficult topics to talk with Malians about because they don't really understand what they're getting from their government and what they're getting from this peace process, except to know that we have to have it. We have to have peace. We have to have a peace process. We have to have a peace accord. So these elections are an opportunity to have that discussion. Hopefully this runoff will allow for some debate and discussion about issues and not just about our side against your side and who's going to win. I agree with Peter that I think Ibi Ka has a very strong chance of coming out ahead. Sumala Cisse provides an alternative view, but frankly, this goes with what we've seen in a lot of other places in Africa. Perhaps it's time for some more choices and newer leadership and newer opportunities for people to come to the table and present some new ideas. Mali needs that, and hopefully we'll get some of that maybe out of some of the upcoming elections for the legislature.
So back to you, J. Peter Pham. This election just for the president or also for legislature?
This election's just for the president.
All right. So talk about this peace accord. Wasn't it signed in 2015 between the government and the separatist Tuareg rebels? And if that's the case, I don't want to underestimate how difficult it is to implement something of that nature, but what's the situation? What's the status of that? And you would think that some progress would have been made thus far.
Well, actually, this is one of the ironies in all this. The problem with implementing the Algiers Accord, which would give greater autonomy to the northern part of the country, where there have been a sense historically of ethnic groups that are marginalized. The problem with that is that Mali is a democracy. I don't mean that there's problems with democracies, but over 80% of the population do not belong to the ethnic groups in the north. And they view it as a concession to people who rebelled and caused the country to teeter on the edge of collapse several years ago. So it's not very popular. So the administration may have signed these accords, but if it had fully implemented them, I don't think Ibi Ka would have gotten his 42% of the vote this first time. So I think this is one of the ironies, is that implementing what needs to be done, at least in the view of those more detached from it, is very difficult politically because your voters are not necessarily in favor of giving this away. They have not yet fully appreciated the extent of that. So I think that's an important thing to keep in mind.
But voting is going to take place in the north where the separatists live, correct?
In many places, it will take place. Some places, in fact, we don't have the full list of places that where voting was not able to occur in the first round. But one suspects most of them are in the north or the middle part of the country. And certainly that's more sparsely populated. So the percentage of voters who are disenfranchised if polling places don't open is much smaller number. Not that that's right. Interestingly, Mr. Cisse, the former prime minister who's running against the incumbent president, is himself born in Timbuktu in the north. On the other hand, Mr. Keita, the incumbent president, is actually married to a northerner. So this is not literally not black and white. It is much more complex.
But JT, in terms of these two candidates, who do you think the voters in the north who perhaps sympathize with the separatists, who are they likely to support?
Well, I think what this really comes down to, I mean, we can't get into the mind of all the voters, but if you look at the provisional numbers, Ibekab does carry some support there, and that coupled with what he gets in the southern part of the country is going to be helpful. Somalia Cisse obviously has a small sort of stronghold of votes, and I think he may have an opportunity to consolidate that with a lessened candidate field in a runoff. But ultimately, I think the power of the incumbency is going to reign supreme. And I do go back to upcoming National Assembly elections. I think that is going to be another opportunity for us to see how the political alignment plays out, because this legislative institution needs to play a better role of providing oversight and a check on the presidency.
Back to you, Jay Peterfond, very quickly before we turn briefly to the DRC. In terms of Mali, there's so much at stake with the violence. And as you said, MINUSMA, it's one of the most deadly peacekeeping missions. 169 peacekeepers have been killed. Why is it so dangerous? And what's at stake in terms of geopolitical interests and security?
Well, if we've learned anything in the last two decades of fighting conflicts around the globe, not just in Africa, the only way you win a counterinsurgency is political legitimacy, inclusion. And so an election is not going to guarantee of that, but it's an important step towards that. So that leads us to the security issue. And it's not just Mali. These borders are porous. The special operations forces that were attacked in the ambush in Niger came over the border from Mali. So these conflicts spill from Mali to Mauritania to Niger to Burkina Faso. So it's all intertwined. The election, the first round as we saw it, actually, there are some important lessons that will bear out in the legislative elections that JT referred to. And that is the Malians have actually, to their credit, developed a fairly credible, transparent system. Every ballot paper is signed by the chairman of the precinct, the representative of the governing party, the elected representative of the opposition, plus two assessors who are there at the counting. So if there's a ballot in there that's not signed by these people, that's tossed out. So they have developed some interesting systems to do it.
That reminds me, maybe we could learn here in the United States from them in terms of securing our election. Well, back to you as we close, JT, DRC. We have some news out of the Democratic Republic of Congo.
We've heard that President Kabila, who is about 2 years over his constitutional term, will not be running for elections, which are tentatively scheduled for December. I think some of us still are wondering if those elections will be able to take place. But this is a huge change in the political landscape now because, of course, the big point of tension was, will this guy run again? Will he do as many thought he would do, which is refuse to step down, refuse to follow the constitutional process? We've already seen that happen with his inability to hold elections on time as the Constitution dictates, as his term expired. He's well over his term. The fact that he's going to go through this process and elevate a new player, endorse that, I think changes the game, changes it for the opposition, and also probably buys the government some credit in terms of the international community and the pressure being placed upon them.
The last word to you, Jay Peterfond.
I agree. It was a surprising decision announced by the president, Joseph Kabila, that he wouldn't run again. And so I think it's a positive step that he's at least respecting that much of the Constitution. On the other hand, there is going to be a question, if this election is held, of how legitimate it will be, given the fact that one of the potential leading candidates in the poll was not even allowed to enter the country, Moise Katumbi, to register his candidacy, much less to have his candidacy debated or anything else. So that's going to cast a slight pall over it, separate from the issue of his eligibility to register.
We will end on that cautiously optimistic note. I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guest, Jay Peterfond, Vice President for Research and Regional Initiatives and Director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, and John Tomaszewski, JT. He's Regional Director for Africa at the International Republican Institute. Gentlemen, thanks so much for your terrific analysis.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Our engineer was Joe Gill, and I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter. on the Voice of America.